Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the Syrian conflict has now taken more than 150,000 lives and displaced more than 4 million people. We'll discuss the latest dynamics and debate the possible solutions to the crisis. But first, in remembrance of the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, we revisit the tragedy with Senator Romeo Dallaire, who witnessed the atrocities firsthand. Romeo Dallaire was the commander of the United Nations peacekeeping forces in Rwanda and had tried to stop the genocide of Tutsis. He's the author of Shake Hands with the Devil and They Fight Like Soldiers, They Die Like Children. He's also the co-director of The Will to Intervene. General Dallaire, I wonder if we could start with your return to Rwanda. I recently revisited a talk you gave on the internet where you addressed the Rwandan people and where you apologized for your failures.
In my tour, the 10th anniversary, I said that I would like to stop and speak at a class at University of Butare, the National University. We're doing the trip around the country. When we arrived there, they had to move it to the outside stadium, football stadium. And there was about 7,000 people there. And so I spoke. And one of the things I emphasized, not only the fact that I, as the commander of the mission, failed and my mission failed to protect them and to establish an atmosphere of security, I said the era of the white man coming back to Africa to reestablish security and so on is over. I said the sub-Saharan black African is simply not going to attract the engagement of the developed world, the North, unless there is a self-interest in there, and a country like Rwanda doesn't have that. And I said, you will have to take on, through your organizations like the African Union, the ability to self-protect. As I was saying, the white man is not coming back. The clouds had started to form because it was a rainy season. So in the rainy season, it's lovely sunny, and all of a sudden, boom, clouds appear. And then the next thing you know, downpour. And as I'm saying this, the sky got black, and I had just finished saying it, and this incredible thunder clap just happened. And it reverberated over the corrugated scale roofs of the stadium. And it was an incredible reaction. And it just made such an impact that afterwards so many of them came back and said, even the skies recognized that we were into a new era.
One of the things you said on the video that I did see was you were talking about how the Western world and the United Nations responded to Yugoslavia. Mm-hmm. But not to Rwanda.
Yeah. The video you mentioned, which is also called Shake Hands with the Devil, of my trip back at the 10th anniversary with my wife and rewalking the terrain of the genocide. One of the horrific quandaries in which you find yourself in the field is that you have to operate with what you're given, but you're also conscious of what's going on elsewhere. And as I was fighting to get even a budget, let alone the troops I needed, even getting them food, and then the genocide explodes, and the next thing I know, countries are pulling their troops out, and I'm getting the orders, in fact, to withdraw, which I'm refusing. At the same time, Dayton had happened, and we deployed 67,000 troops in ex-Yugoslavia. And the question is how come I couldn't keep 450 soldiers to provide protection to a small portion of that population, and there were more people killed, injured, internally displaced, refugeed, and raped in 100 days in Rwanda than there was in the 6 years of the Yugoslavian campaign? And so what are the criteria that our political elites use? I think the most pejorative side of that is our populations and citizens let them get away with to decide that they're going to invest massively in a European country that's in internally hemorrhaging, but that sub-Saharan black Africans simply don't count. Not only that, but Yugoslavia has no real significant natural resource. It's just situated in Europe. You sort of say, well, you know, it's there as part of maybe the European security context. In Rwanda, there was nothing there either, but the people didn't at all feel ashamed of saying that, you know, there's nothing in Rwanda. There's no oil, no strategic resource. There's nothing of any value. Anything that's there are human beings, and there's too many of them anyway. And so they use that argument.
Did you actually hear that argument?
Yes. No, that was I was briefed. nations and powerful nations came in within the first week to do assessments. They sent in a small reconnaissance team to look at the situation and then to be able to go back to their national capitals and then decide whether or not they're going to give the UN any resources. That's where the exercise changed in regards to who really is ultimately responsible. Up until the time that these nation states actually came on the ground and looked at the situation, the UN was running the show, and the UN was providing the information to the Security Council, and they were feeding all the nations and all the national capitals and so on. But when these countries came to Rwanda, looked at it and decided they weren't not going to come in, then that meant that they had decided that they would not provide the UN with the resources it needed to stop the genocide. Then that responsibility of the genocide fell on those nation states. And so ultimately, the culprit, or the ones that are really have blood on their hands, are not necessarily the Secretariat of the UN, nor in the field, although we made mistakes, and of course we have a sense of responsibility, as I do as the mission force commander. But those who deliberately took decisions not to provide the UN with any assets to influence the situation, they're the ones that are to be held accountable for the continuum of the slaughter and ultimately the genocide. And that's every nation state in the world. That's why the subtitle of my book, Shake Hands with the Devil, is The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. They completely lost their sense of humanity amongst themselves with the slaughter. But the rest of humanity abandoned the Rwandans.
So you named several failures that we have to learn from. The failure in humanity in Rwanda, the failure of humanity in the international community, perhaps it's even a bigger failure in that it's what shapes our considerations. And then it sounds like the institutional failures as well.
It would be just too easy to use the only international body that exists that has the ability to bring nations together and regions of the world together on a variety of subjects. I mean, the UN was founded by those five permanent members essentially to prevent them from going to war with each other. And all the rest of the stuff that's come on since, you know, UNESCO and everything else, UNICEF, have been additions in the maturing of that ability. And peacekeeping only started in 1956 with the concept where belligerents decide that they don't want to fight anymore, and they need a sort of a referee to make sure that people play by the rules as they reestablish them. The concept was based on the fact that nation states would be going after other nation states. And then when the Cold War ended, it found itself all of a sudden facing a whole series of imploding nations and failing states that previously had been held under wraps by the big powers, in fact, mostly the permanent five, who had put a lot of dictators in power and, you know, kept control on these artificial countries that came out of the colonial era. So bingo, they find themselves all of a sudden having to face these catastrophic failures with very, very demanding timelines. There's revolutions, there's assassinations, there's breakdown in social structures, and worse than that, there's massive abuse of human rights. There's a fundamental sort of visceral desire to sort these problems out by actually going at the other ethnicities, tribalism, and religious reasons. So much of that explodes. Didn't come on slowly, it exploded. And it was the Cambodia, it was Somalia, due to famine. You had the Congo that was starting up. And in Central Africa, you had also Burundi that had a coup d'etat, and then Rwanda, which was in a civil war. And on the West Africa, well, you had Sierra Leone that was teetering on war. You had Liberia. I mean, this place was just festering of peoples wanting to sort out what their nation state should be, because they were created in artificial boundaries with no logic at all in their sort of ethnic groups or whatever. The UN all of a sudden faces this, and the international community says, oh, by the by, Cold War is over, peace dividend, we don't need big militaries anymore, we don't have to spend on expensive security systems, life is going to be in a new world order. George Bush Sr. Yeah. said that. And on the contrary, it may have sounded secure up in the northern part in the Europe sort of developed world, at least for a while, until Yugoslavia exploded. The rest of the world was going to hell in a handbasket. And the UN was the only body left to pick up the pieces. didn't have the tools, didn't have the people, didn't have the structure. Peacekeeping was a very small little select group of about 13 developed countries that would go in, you know, when nation states were at each other. All of a sudden, what you needed was fighting troops. You needed people who could defend others. And it exploded into something of in the order, by the time I got there in 93, of about 50,000 troops around the world with no equipment, no logistics, and mandates that people were pulling out of the air to try to figure out. I mean, my mandate was establish an atmosphere of security. So you sort of say, okay, I've been 30 years in NATO, and my mandates have been to attack, defend, withdraw, bypass. You know, I've even handled nuclear weapons. All of a sudden, I'm in a developing country in the middle of nowhere, and I'm told to establish an atmosphere of security. And the question is, what does establish mean? Do I defend a country when I'm demobilizing both armies against a third party? How far do I use my troops in using force to establish? And what is an atmosphere of security?
Right.
A police state? No weapons? And so mandates started to come out. No resources came to the UN because at that time, the big powers, in particular the United States, had said, that's it, we're not paying anymore because a lot of this money is wasted. So massive deficits were there. We couldn't get budgets to deploy troops. And the real kicker in this comes from the fact that the developed countries start to do a Pontius Pilate trick on the UN. And what they do is they say, okay, these are all brush wars and these are problems there and so on. There's really nothing in it for us that much. And on top of that, you got Somalia and you got Black Hawk Down, and Bill Clinton gets cold feet and pulls out, or accelerates anyways the pullout. So the world power is not keen on playing in this. And so the UN has to go to developing countries to pick up the slack. And they've got no skills, they've got no equipment, they've got no logistics. And yet the same permanent five are still creating mandates to go into Cambodia and go into Mozambique and in Rwanda. But we don't want you to spend money. We want you to minimum force, minimum capabilities, and get out of there as fast as you can. Well, that abdication by the developed world, the white world in particular, to letting the UN carry the can, established the whole strategic scenario in which ultimately, extremists could thrive because they argued that nobody's really going to come. And that's what these guys did in Rwanda. They developed the genocide plan. I mean, they sat around, they developed a plan right down to every 10 huts in the country. They had lists of every Tutsi, where they were. They had lists of every intermarried couple that existed. And the militia was created out of their youth movement that they trained and armed and equipped, and it was all evolving. We were passing all that information up, and there was nothing coming back because nobody wanted to play in it. Why? Because they were all busy with sort of Cambodia, maybe closing down a bit. We were busy with Haiti that was cranking up, that's close to home, and Yugoslavia was building up. So, hey, Rwanda, who's interested? So from a situation during the Cold War of maybe three or four missions going on at any time, and all of them Chapter 6, non-threatening, we end up by 1993 with 15 UN missions, and all of them are Chapter 7, which means the use of force. The last time they had used the Chapter 7 in the Cold War was Korea. So you can imagine the learning curve, particularly within the UN structure, but also the nations that are trying to fill the void abandoned by developed countries. And abandoned is not a facile statement, because when in Rwanda during the genocide, I was able to convince a number of Franco and Anglo-African nations to provide me with the battalions I needed, I couldn't get them there because the developed countries didn't want to give me the strategic lift to move them. And then when we worked out a deal that the developed countries would sort of sponsor a battalion. As an example, the Americans were going to sponsor the Ghanaian battalion. So they needed armored personnel vehicles, they needed radios and machine guns. Out of the thousands of armored vehicles sitting in Germany, doing nothing but rusting, they went into a lengthy negotiation of rental. So the United States rented 50 armored personnel vehicles for $14 million. And it took over a month to negotiate it, let alone get the stuff there, get it painted white, put the radios in it that we were scrounging from somewhere else. It was perverse. absolutely perverse. Meanwhile, behind the scenes, the French are fiddling with the extremists because the French believe that Rwanda is going to turn into an Anglo country because the rebels were Anglophiles. And they thought that the Americans were really trying to muscle into their realm of the Franco-Africa. And so they were supporting
the
one side.
Government.
Yeah. And so you get also a nation, a world power, supporting the extremists to the extent of supporting them that they then convince the UN, which has nothing left. I mean, it's got nothing in the bins. It's got no money.
And what month is this roughly now?
We're now in about the end of May, June. So we're 2 months into the genocide. We've got about 500,000 bodies floating all over the place. And we're close to about 3 million people.
And the French are still supporting the Hutu, knowing that there are 500,000 bodies.
To the extent that they convinced the Security Council that it's unacceptable to continue to see this slaughter going on. Because they all hoped that the thing would end in a couple of weeks, but it didn't. It kept on going because there was nothing to stop them. The French said, we got to stop this. They said, we want a Chapter 7 mission, and we're going to go in with a combined force of Franco-African countries, and we will establish a humanitarian protection zone. So what they do is they bring in about 2,000 French soldiers. Most of them were already in Africa and other areas. And they bring in a platoon from Senegal and a platoon from Mali and a couple others to just sort of give them a color of being a multilateral force. And they come in with Jaguar jets, armored vehicles, heavy guns and so on. And they're not coming in there to establish a humanitarian protection zone. They're coming in for a big fight. And so I end up as a Chapter 6 mission that was a peacekeeping mission, establishing the demilitarized zone between the rebel forces that are advancing and winning and the French forces that are trying to establish a humanitarian protection zone, which really is a zone where the extremists were hiding and rearming. So I'm a UN mission being the patroller and a negotiator between the other UN mission and the rebel force.
You just made me think when you're talking about the rebel forces and Paul Kagame, who I think is still president, He's kind of become a Western media darling in a way. Mm. But there's been some talk in certain academic circles that he was leading an equally brutal force and then also shot down the plane of the president, allegedly. Do you think that Paul Kagame is as culpable as, say, the other side?
No, no, and no, and no, and all the questions. There is no doubt that Paul Kagame is ruthless. He grew up in a refugee camp. Their family was thrown out of Rwanda by the Hutu extremists, fought with Museveni to get rid of Idi Amin and Obote, studied here in the United States at Leavenworth, a very effective commander. His officers and NCOs were very effective in the Ugandan army. So they were then under pressure from the Ugandans to get out of Uganda. These refugee camps were creating problems for them. And so they wanted to go back to Rwanda or at least get a Rwandan passport so they can go somewhere else. Rwandans refused and that took off the war. So he's got a big chip on his shoulder on how his family and him, they have been treated and how they find themselves after fighting for the Ugandans being thrown out but not having a place to go. So they take matters in their own hands. So you do have a rebel force, however, that is incredibly disciplined and well-trained and well-motivated and focused and well-led with a political structure that has a very high educated strata to it that has looked at what they want to do should they win the war. On the other side, you've got a government force and a government structure that is torn between extremists and moderates, that is a force that is not well-trained, not well-motivated, that is really nearly decrepit, except for some elite units, and has within it a visceral hatred for the Tutsis that is nurtured by the political elite wing, which is extremist, that is influencing the whole of the structure of not only military, but the gendarmerie and also the public service. So you've got this gang that essentially has said that the only way we're going to be able to keep power, because we've got a dictator here, is by eliminating the opposition. And the peace agreement that was signed in 93 essentially eroded so much of the power of the dictator that they felt that they were in fact vulnerable to being thrown in jail, these extremists. The power struggle was, how do we get rid of the Tutsis in order to sustain power, and can we do it? And their assessment of what the reaction of the international community was is we probably would be able to pull it off. They had seen what had happened in coup d'etat in Burundi in October, and there had been next to no response. And I ended up with 300,000 Burundi refugees and over 40,000 bodies floating in the river. So there was next to no reaction in the international community. They thought that they would be able to pull it off, and so they did it. So there was, on one side, a very structured force with a deliberate aim that they were coming back home and they wanted their share of power. On the other side, you had a gang that had taken power but had sort of languished ineptitude under a dictator, and their structures were riddled by extremist thinking, but also caught up in a quandary because there were moderates also there, particularly in the South, that didn't necessarily agree with what was going on. So the extremists take control and they create a scenario in which they can launch their genocide, and they actually implement it. So a genocide happened. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. No revisionism by academics and all kinds of NGOs that have looked at it. Alison DeForge, even in her work previous to that, recognized that there was a genocide that happened. No problem there. Question is, with that genocide, there was a civil war. So the rebel forces are attacking the government forces. In the nature of civil wars, the general population is not on the sides and watch these soldiers fight. The general population is an instrument of war. And what you do is you create a mass of population in order to be your negotiating base when peace comes or peace agreements or when you have to negotiate. So the extremists decide to move the general population and exterminate the Tutsis as they're doing it. So they move millions of people. And they create fear that permits that movement by the extremist radio station that describes the rebels as demons, that they have long teeth, they even have a tail, they have horns, they eat Hutu babies, and on and on and on and on. And this is a highly illiterate population, and so whatever comes off the radio is nearly the voice of God. Add rape to that, and you have then a nation that is now mobile. With that scenario going on, they are moving massive numbers of people and they're slaughtering. The rebel forces are coming down, and what do they find? Slaughtered family. A lot of these people still had family in Rwanda. Although close to a million Tutsis escaped in 1959-60, close to a million still stayed in Rwanda. So you had at the time about 1.2 million Tutsis in the country, plus those who were mixed marriages. The bulk of them were slaughtered, and they had family in the peripheral areas, and these forces were the sons and daughters of the people who had been thrown out. And so when they're coming down through the villages and they're finding their family slaughtered, what do you think happens? So exactions go on, and they are interestingly structured in as much as Kagame court-martialed and shot soldiers who raped. He also prevented looting from happening, but he also had a strong paranoia on security. And because his force was smaller, much smaller than the other side, and of large territory with vast populations, he wanted to ensure that he had security behind him. And so he conducted a sort of a follow-on in regards to ensuring that there were no extremists left behind as they continued to advance to the country. And so there were exactions done. The scale of that is still up for grabs. How much of that was done? How many of the Hutu officers and families that were slaughtered? How many of the refugees who were Hutu came back and were culled for those who had committed slaughter? And remember, here we have no more government, we've got no more structure. And essentially, to blame a person for having conducted a rape or killing of a neighbor, all you needed was five witnesses. And so there were, yeah, exactions. And the scale is to be questioned. But there's nowhere near the similitude or the link between an actual genocide that would have wiped out the 1.2 million Tutsis and as its aim and then keep control of the country, and the other guy who's coming in and trying to keep control both of his own troops but also of establishing a secure environment, which in the scenarios of civil wars can be horrifically ruthless.
Thank you so much, Senator Dallaire.
Yeah.
It's great to have you with us.
Thank you.
When we come back, the Syrian conflict has become more deadly and complicated. What are the possible means to resolve it? Stay tuned.
A father slumps back into his chair, choking back the tears his fear realized. In the doorway, eyes swell with mother's tears as the uniforms draw near. Regret to inform you.
This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. The Syrian conflict has now taken more than 150,000 lives and displaced more than 4 million people. What are the possible means to resolve it? We're joined by Fred Lawson. Fred Lawson is a professor of government at Mills College and the author of Global Security Watch Syria, Constructing International Relations in the Arab World, and Why Syria Goes to War, 30 Years of Confrontation. Also joining us is Nader Hashemi. He's a professor of international studies at the University of Denver and the author of The Syria Dilemma and Toward a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies. He is also co-editor of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Marcy Patton also joins us. Marcy Patton is a professor of politics at Fairfield University. She's the author of Turkey's Tug of War, and she's a contributing author to Politics and Society in the Contemporary Middle East. Welcome, and thank you for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Fred Lawson, I'd like to begin with you on the dynamics in Syria today. You wrote that since the winter of 2012, really we've had this growth in radical Islamist groups in the involvement there. Can you help us understand the conflict today as opposed to a year ago?
One of the crucial changes that's taken place in Syria just over the last year or so is the rise of a variety of different kinds of Islamist movements that have competing programs, Islamist movements that have different outside sponsors. And the Islamist movements have taken the vanguard, they've taken the lead, especially in the fighting on the ground inside Syria. And as these groups have become predominant, have taken over territory in different parts of the country, they have fallen into rivalry with one another. The group that was the original radical Islamist group called the Assistance Front for the People of Syria, that the New York Times and other people called Jabhat al-Nusra. The Assistance Front immediately created a challenger to itself called the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. And those two groups have been skirmishing with each other. Those two groups have been trying to build a constituency for each other all over the northern part of the country. And so that dynamic of fighting among Islamist groups has really eclipsed a lot of the other dynamics going on in the civil war.
Thinking back to this piece you just published where you had something like 18 groups engaged in the area now, would you say that it is too complex to understand this as a religious conflict between Sunni and Shia and Alawite?
Boy, the fine line that I always have to find myself walking is to somehow talk about the subtleties and the complexities of the conflict in Syria without making the whole situation sound so complicated and hard to understand that people just give up on it. I think if we do focus on a primary line of conflict, this primary line of conflict between largely local based Islamist radical groups versus groups that largely consist of fighters from outside the country, I think that's one important line of demarcation across the struggle that doesn't have us talk about the hundreds of different militias that have grown up. And so one of the things that's a defining characteristic, I think, of the fighting up in the north part of Syria now is the struggle between groups that have some local connection to villages and provinces in the north, competing with other Islamist groups that are largely made up of foreigners, made up of Chechens or of Britons or of people who have come into Syria from outside the country. And that struggle has been shaping the course of the conflict in the last few months.
Nader Hashemi.
Yeah, I would agree with everything that Fred has said. I would just sort of add a broader contextual point that the rise of these radical Islamist groups, both from outside of Syria and those that have indigenous roots within Syria, this rise is a direct, I think, consequence of the absence of serious prospects for political change and democratization. In other words, there is a deep and intimate relationship in terms of the politics of the Middle East between democratization, prospects for political change on the one hand, and the rise of radical politics, violent politics on the other. The more the prospects for democratization and political change move up, the less likely there is a chance for radical, violent Islamist groups to emerge. And that's something that, you know, we've seen in the context of the Arab Spring, when there was sort of hope and optimism for political change. Al-Qaeda and radical sort of Islamist groups that were committed to violent political change sort of lost their appeal. But as the prospects for political change and democratization diminished, these groups started to gain a following and started to assert themselves. And this is, I think, something that's playing itself out in the case of Syria today. If you see from the beginning of the uprising in Syria, it was largely peaceful, it was nonviolent. There seemed to be hope for political change, but as the peaceful demonstrations sort of turned violent and as the uprising became militarized, and as the hope and optimism for political change within the country started to diminish, you saw a predictable rise of different forms of radical Islamist groups asserting themselves, winning new adherents, and starting to shape the conflict in very significant ways.
So in part, you see this as a result of the regime cracking down brutally, but also it sounds from what you've said and also from your writing that it's partly a failure of the international community to come up with something that would bring the region into some kind of accord.
Well, absolutely. I mean, fundamentally, I lay the blame primarily on at the doorstep of the Assad regime for its crackdown, for its inability to sort of seriously contemplate political change, to negotiate seriously with its opposition. But also, yeah, and from the perspective of the broader international community seriously hasn't been interested in trying to, I think, come up with credible solutions that can solve this conflict. And so the more that stays in place, the more there's a sense of despair, frustration, and the more that creates a set of social conditions that allow for radical Islamist groups to thrive, to prosper, to sort of win over adherents, and to start to assert themselves into this conflict.
Marcy Patton, would you agree?
Yes, definitely I would agree. The international community has been remarkably ineffective in coming up with an ability to reconcile the two groups, the opposition and the Assad regime, to get them to talk. And there's also a lot of disharmony amongst the international actors who have an interest in what's happening in Syria. What comes to mind to me is the country Turkey, which is the one I know best. Turkey, for example, was very much in favor of going forward with the bombing of Syria that President Obama suggested. And it has become a haven for some of the Islamist fighters to cross over into Syria in order to attack communities. So there are a lot of international actors who have different interests at stake in basically there not being a solution to the problem.
Do you bring up the Turkish element, which then would emphasize what some of the minority groups in Syria are facing, particularly the Armenians and the Kurds, the other Christians? Fred Lawson, what about the minority communities?
Well, it's very important that you've mentioned the Kurdish community inside Syria, because that community is almost always lost. If I give a talk about the situation in Syria, I almost always leave the Kurds to the very end. But right at the moment, I think the Kurds lie at the heart of the struggle and maybe at the heart of whatever might happen next in the struggle. Because as the Islamist groups took over different villages and provinces up in the north central part of the country, some of these Islamist groups started persecuting minority communities, started imposing a very strict, not at all mainstream, notion of how an Islamic community should work, and the Kurds mobilized to defend their local villages and to defend their local districts. And now these Kurdish militias and Kurdish parties have pretty much taken charge of a couple of cities and a couple of provinces up in the north. These Kurdish-led, Kurdish-administered parts of the country have not said that they want to be independent. They've not said that they want to break away from Syria. But how those Kurdish areas are going to manage their relations with the rest of the opposition or their relations with the regime in Damascus is almost an open question. And a lot of the fighting that's taken place just up until a week or so ago has been fighting between Kurdish armed militias versus various Islamist militias. And that battle has been hard fought up there in some of the oil provinces and then along the border with Turkey.
And what of the Christian minorities that were in Syria?
I asked myself that same question about 3 months ago. What are the various Christian communities doing except suffering? And lo and behold, about, I think it was mid-February, Joshua Landis's blog, Syria Comment, ran a long study, a long report about a couple of the Christian communities, the Chaldeans and the Assyrians, who have started to mobilize up in the Jazeera, up in the Euphrates River Valley as well, mobilize local militias to protect their villages, partly to protect them from the Islamist movements, but partly to keep their villages safe from the struggle going on between the Kurds and the Islamists. Now, the opposition usually calls those Christian militias pro-regime and thinks that, by definition, those Christian militias are fighting against opposition forces. But I think that's probably an overstatement. It's probably more the case that, once again, we've got another set of local militias that, as Nader says, have pretty much given up on normal politics and instead are turning to force.
And Nader Hashemi, you've written quite a bit about the religious aspect of the Middle East. What about the minority communities?
I would agree with everything that Fred just said. I would just add sort of, again, a broader sort of contextual and sort of historic point here about the status of minorities in the Middle East, and particularly with respect to Syria. And, of course, minority communities are vulnerable because they are minority communities by definition, and the natural tendency is for them to sort of stick with the status quo that they're familiar with. In the case of Syria, you know, the minorities, communities, particularly the Christians, have been able to prosper. They were sort of relatively stable. And the general view with respect to the conflict over the last 3 years is that most Christians are sort of sympathetic to the status quo, to the Assad regime, and they're very fearful of the opposition coming to power. But I think there's an important point here that should not be lost. And this is really, I think, something that the minority communities themselves have to think about with respect to their future status in the Middle East. There is no fundamental security for minority communities in the Middle East when the majority communities which they live with, if those majority communities are living in insecurity, then there can be no security for the minority communities. And that's sort of, I think, a general, I think, truism that applies across the Middle East. Most majority populations feel that they don't have proper representation in the states that they live in. They don't have proper legal protection. They don't view the states that they live in as being legitimate political entities. And so they are agitating for political change, and they're advocating for, democratization, broadly speaking. And I don't think there can be sort of long-term stability for minority communities in an authoritarian political context. Fundamentally, the only way that minority communities, I think, can have security is through a process of gradual political change and the creation of strong legal constitutional frameworks that both protect the rights of minority communities, both in law, but also in actual enforcement of the law. And this is something that's not new to Syria or the Middle East. I mean, we've had minority communities living among majority populations throughout the course of human history. And the only examples, the working examples that we have that effectively work are ones where there is a stable, democratic, constitutional framework in place where all of the stakeholders, both the minority communities and the majority communities, have a sense of buy-in to the political systems that they are living in. And I think that broad lesson also applies to the case of Syria. Now, how we get from where we are today in the context of a raging civil war and chaos and to a point where you can have a process of democratic negotiation and bargaining and constitutional protection, that distance, I think Syria needs to travel, the Middle East needs to travel, it's a very uncertain path. But I think fundamentally, if one is thinking about long-term goals where minority communities can be stable and secure in the context of living amongst majority populations, the only model that I think really works is the one where there is democracy, where there is a strong legal culture and a strong constitutional system in place that can provide protection for all of the citizens of a political community.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarscircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We're talking about Syria and the Middle East today and what the potential solutions are. Marcy Patton, let's bring you back in now. You were talking about Turkey and how some of these groups, particularly the Islamist groups, the extreme groups, are finding haven there. What is Turkey's relationship to some of these groups, given that the minorities in Syria are some of the same minorities that are in Turkey, the Kurds, the Assyrians, the Armenians?
My first point would be that Turkey has been very generous in absorbing refugees from these minority communities, Christian communities, Alevi communities, Alevi Shiite communities, Kurdish communities, Armenian communities. But they really are situated as unwelcome guests in Turkey. And because Turkey is a majority Sunni country, the prime minister of Turkey is a strong backer of the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood and has very decided views, very sort of anti-minority views, I would say. So that although they've been absorbed into Turkey in terms of, refugee camps, their situation is very precarious. They're not likely to be absorbed into Turkish society very easily. And they find themselves really in a situation of limbo.
Let's broaden to the other regional players as well. Fred Lawson, you've been writing about this new configuration in the Middle East in terms of security in particular. You've said it's an intricate web of interstate security dynamics. How has it changed?
Just for instance, one of the important connections between Syria and a neighboring country has to do with northern Iraq. In northern Iraq, over the last year and a half or so, there's been a mobilization of a variety of different opposition movements, movements that are irritated, to say the least, with the government of Nouri al-Maliki in Baghdad, who think that Nouri al-Maliki has become increasingly authoritarian, is pretty much manipulating the electoral system, not only for his personal benefit, but for the benefit of the Shi'i community inside Iraq. So a number of sectarian groups, political groups, up in the northwest part of Iraq near Syria have been holding protests and attacking government installations and building bridges with armed groups across the border inside Syria. And I think what we see is that the fighting inside Syria has started to resonate, has started to find some echo inside the politics of Iraq as well. And political movements, critics of the prime minister in Iraq that might have played by the kind of rules that Professor Hashmi talks about in Iraq are instead taking to the streets and are instead using violence to get their platform across. So there is this wave of turning away from established institutions and a wave of taking up arms against established governments that seems to be creeping across Syria's borders.
You've also described it as a new Arab Cold War. How is it a Cold War?
That crucial phrase was pretty much invented by Malcolm Kerr at University of California, Los Angeles, who just 30 years ago, in fact, was assassinated as he was president of American University of Beirut. Malcolm Kerr's original notion of the Arab Cold War, as I understand it, was that different Arab governments in the 1950s and 1960s were more interested in strategic domestic rivalry and more interested in leadership in regional affairs than they were about ideological principles. So that even though it looked like the region in the 1950s was divided along ideological lines, in fact, there was a more subtle collection of political games taking place across the region. And I think, too, even today, it's tempting to think about what's going on in the Middle East in terms of something like Shi'is fighting Sunnis, or something like radicals associated with Iran fighting against conservatives or reactionaries associated with Qatar. But in fact, I think just like in the 1950s, those broad ideological labels are more misleading than they are helpful. And in fact, we need to take a careful look at the kinds of alliances that have taken shape, and they don't always line up along clear, neat ideological lines.
Nader Hashemi, how do you see the regional dynamics developing now?
Well, I think there's two big things that are happening. One, obviously, that the longer this conflict in Syria plays itself out, the more it destabilizes the region. Reportedly today, the fourth largest sort of city in Jordan is a Syrian refugee camp. Just this past week, we hear reports that 12,000 people every single day are fleeing from Syria into Lebanon, where now more than a million Syrian refugees are located. Lebanon has been deeply destabilized because of the Syrian conflict. Different sides in Lebanon supporting different factions. There's bombings and assassinations taking place on a regular basis. And of course, in western Iraq, we've seen the Syrian conflict spread across the Iraqi-Syrian border. There was reports not too long ago about the rise of, these jihadi groups that are on both sides of the border taking over Fallujah and Ramadi. So I think that destabilization is taking place. The other sort of related point here is that there's been an upsurge in Sunni-Shia sectarianism across the Middle East, for which Syria is another battleground. I mean, Iraq has been a battleground. Lebanon has been a battleground. Now Syria is the new battleground. And, sectarian forces who are benefiting from perpetuating sectarianism are using the conflict in Syria to sort of advance their own agenda. So we've seen an upsurge. And all of this, I think, fundamentally boils down to the regional rivalry between, the two major players in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia and Iran, who are backing different sides in the Syrian conflict. That rivalry is fueling sectarianism, and it's poisoning the politics of the Middle East. And then the sort of related development is the one that we've sort of already touched upon, is that the longer this conflict sort of plays itself out, the more that we see destabilization and killing and violence, the more Syria becomes the new Afghanistan. And now Syria today is a haven, a magnet for attracting in, for drawing in sort of foreign fighters from around the world. And now this is having a major effect not only on the stability and security of the Middle East, but in Europe and the United States increasingly over the last 2 months, you're seeing reports of the Syrian conflict affecting European security and North American security as a direct result of the al-Qaedaization, if you will, of the conflict in Syria. If you read sort of the security and intelligence reports in Europe and the United States, that's the big concern, that now Syria is this new safe haven, and it's no longer Afghanistan. There's some reports that, al-Qaeda-supported elements control over 400, kilometers of territory, more than they ever have been able to exercise influence. And so these are some of the repercussions and the, in many ways, I would argue, predictable consequences of the ongoing conflict in Syria.
I know you, Nader, have written some op-ed pieces, and your book sort of centers on this idea of the international community having an obligation to intervene in some way. What do you see as possible, given how much it is mired in different factional violence and how truly intractable it seems?
Well, I think, I mean, there's lessons here. I mean, the longer this conflict drags on, the more difficult it is to put it back together or to suggest solutions. But fundamentally, unless there's some international power that's willing to step up and try and mobilize a serious effort to resolve this conflict, it's going to carry on for another 20 years, and I suspect Syria will start to look very much like Somalia. And so in terms of solutions by the international community, I'm reminded of a very similar challenge that was facing the world about 20 years ago in the context of the war in Bosnia, where, you know, you had mass atrocities, you had different sides, you had arguments over, you know, competing irreconcilable differences rooted in history and ethnicity and religion that were playing themselves out, and the international community was basically standing by and watching it happen. And then things started to get out of control, and it was as a direct result of a decision by the Clinton administration to appoint a high-level ambassador, the late Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, who then went around to the various capitals and the regional players, pounded his fist on the table, and sort of laid out a blueprint for how this conflict could be resolved, and used a combination of diplomacy, of military force, and an investment in terms of stabilization and reconstruction to put what was then viewed as to being, you know, the most bloodiest conflict in Europe since World War II, it came to an end. And so unless there is some attempt by the leading powers, both internationally and regionally, to come to an agreement to resolve this issue, I see this conflict playing itself out, producing more victims, and it can last for another 20 years. I mean, the conflict in Lebanon lasted for, what, 15 years, and it was, you know, different competing fiefdoms and factions that were at each other's throat for you know, almost two decades. So I don't see the situation in Syria healing itself and solving itself by itself unless there is an attempt by the key international regional players to agree on a framework for resolving the conflict.
Marcy Patton, would you agree with this assessment? And do you think these are fair comparisons, Bosnia, Somalia?
Yes, I think I agree with Professor Hashemi, and I also think it's an excellent comparison.
You know, looking back on the Bosnian negotiations, one of the things that Richard Holbrooke did that was astonishing at the time and astonishing to look back on was Holbrooke was extraordinarily careful to make sure that every actor that had a major interest in that situation was involved in the negotiation. I don't know if that's where this term stakeholder got started, but Holbrooke made clear that every stakeholder should have a voice, even play a part in the discussion. And one thing that the current American administration has ruled out of court from the very beginning is involving Iran in these discussions. And how we could even imagine a serious negotiation or an agreement that might get implemented without direct Iranian participation is a mystery to me. I think the United States has to think carefully about involving Iran, bringing Iran in. If there's one country in the region that might be able to exercise some leverage over Damascus or might be able to persuade Damascus to take part in a true agreement, I think it's the Islamic Republic, and to leave it out of the room seems like a huge mistake to me.
Given what's going on with Russia and the conflicts that are between Russia and the U.S., Russia and Europe, and that Russia has blocked the U.N. Security Council from acting in Syria, Fred Lawson, how do you see this developing?
It seems to me that from the very beginning, Russia has been acting on principle. Russia has been firmly committed to the principle of respecting the sovereignty of states, been careful not to do anything that would involve outside players in the domestic politics of some member of the United Nations. So Russia has a principled stand, and it's going to stick with it. On the other hand, the Russians feel that they were very badly burned by agreeing with the United Nations resolution over Libya to allow outside actors to impose a no-fly zone for humanitarian reasons over Libya. Russia reluctantly agreed to allow that kind of intervention in Libya, and then what happened was the outside forces got more and more involved and eventually played a part in overturning the Gaddafi regime. And I think the Russians feel that they're not going to be snookered again, and they're not going to give an open They're not going to open the door to outsiders to muck around in regional affairs.
Marcy Patton?
I partially agree with what Fred Lawson said about Russia, but I would also point out that there is a contradiction in Russian behavior in terms of respecting the sovereignty of states over the issue of the Ukraine and the Crimea. And this issue of the Crimea and the Russian occupation of the Crimea also has a bearing on what's going on in Syria, because the more the United States and Russia become entrenched over their different views about what should happen to resolve the Crimea crisis, the less likely they are to be able to work cooperatively on trying to come up with some kind of a peace framework for Syria.
Nader Hashemi.
This is the big question everyone is asking themselves. What does the conflict over Crimea and Ukraine mean for Syria and mean for possible U.S.-Russian cooperation in other parts of the world? And it seems like we're sort of moving back into a Cold War sort of period where the focus of U.S.-European security debates and discussions is going to be over a possible new Cold War and tension between Russia over parts of Europe. And that means that, you know, the conflict in Syria, the conflict in other parts of the world is going to be less of a priority. Now, what this will mean for diplomatic sort of options. Will the United States be able to work with Russia? Will the conflict over Crimea and Ukraine mean that the United States is going to sort of challenge the Russian position and say, look, now that we are in a new Cold War era, we're just going to go alone and sort of challenge Russia both in the context of Ukraine and in the context of Syria? That remains to be seen. I think that's one possible scenario. The other likely scenario is that there will be a sense of, look, the two major powers in the world today, the United States and Russia, simply can't agree on anything. There's no need for another Geneva conference. There's no need for sort of putting Security Council resolutions. And so, the United States and the West will simply turn away and focus its attention on Ukraine, on Crimea, on sort of challenging and sort of dealing with Russia's policies in that theater of conflict. And that would mean that Syria will simply sort of drop off the radar screen in terms of its priorities and in terms of the attention that it has been getting by the major global powers.
Thank you, Marcy Patton, Fred Lawson, Nader Hashemi. Thank you so much for being with us here for the Scholar Circle.
Thank you.
Fred Lawson is a professor of government at Mills College and the author of Global Security Watch Syria, Constructing International Relations in the Arab World, and Why Syria Goes to War, 30 Years of Confrontation. Nader Hashemi is a professor of international studies at the University of Denver and the author of The Syria Dilemma and Toward a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies. He is also co-editor of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Marcy Patton is a professor of politics at Fairfield University. She's the author of Turkey's Tug of War, and she's a contributing author to Politics and Society in the Contemporary Middle East. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.